All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Before we get to my guest this week and something that's bothering me, too, I want to tell you that I'm going to be this weekend, March 23rd and 24th, at Bananas Comedy Club in Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey. So come on out. Anything with bananas in the title has got to be good. Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey. Go online for tickets. And it's this Friday and Saturday, one Friday and two shows Saturday. And March 28th to the 31st, I'm going to be in Bloomington, Minnesota at the Mall of America at Rick Bronson's House of Comedy. So hope you can make it out there. That's Rick Bronson's House of Comedy, March 28th to the 31st. I want to talk about people who are ungrateful. I am still ripped shit about something that happened the other night. So I met somebody who's a friend. Somebody in their family had a baby a couple of months ago. I went out personally and bought the baby gift. I bought shorts and a couple of other things, a bottle of Makers and a pack of smokes. And anyway, I wrapped all that up. And I was meeting this person at a show that we were seeing together. And I had left the package in my car. The gift, because I couldn't take it into the venue. And it was a kind of a cold, rainy night. And I said to the guy, look, I got a present for the kid there. You know, I'm parked a few blocks away from the venue. You can drive me over and I can give you the gift. He's like, I'm not driving you over. I got to get out of here right away. He goes, there's another way you can get it to me. The post office. What the really? Really? Because he needed to get home. I can't. This is why I have to move to the woods. I couldn't believe it. I just drank the Maker's Mark. I don't care. No. But what's going on with people? Are they that sort of just blinded to other people's feelings and needs and whatever? Here I am. I got a gift. I wrapped it. I put it in the car. I need you to drive literally 30 seconds to get me to my car so I don't have to freeze my ass off and give you your gift, and you don't want to take the time? Okay, all right. Listen, do me a favor. Email in any ungrateful stories you have, and I'll pick a few and read them on the air. Just email them to pmercurio@gmail.com. My last name, M-E-C-U-R-I-O, one R in my last name. pmercurio@gmail.com. One R, my last name, not two. Two's that Australian actor. I don't want to get into it. I've talked about it before. All right, my guest this week, Jimmy O. Wang from Silicon Valley, stand-up comedian. He's got a book out. Enjoy him. Fun guy, nice guy. From another country. You guess, based on his name, where he's from. And he talks about being an immigrant here and how he got into stand-up and his parents, who are quite a handful. Anyway, enjoy Jimmy. Hope to see you this weekend at Bananas in Hasbrook Heights or March 28th to the 31st at Rick Bronson's House of Comedy. And email in some stories. I need some misery loves company. Have we started? Okay. I like to start like that so that everybody knows that the show started. So now when they listen to the show, they're going to hear me say, have we started? I'm here with Lisa. First of all, we're both New England people and Red Sox fans, and she's a book representative for the author, actor, comedian, Asian guy.
Mainly Asian guy.
Thank you. Jimmy O. Yang, who is here with a good book called How to American an Immigrant's Guide to Disappointing Your Parents, which is great, and also one of the stars of Silicon Valley, which comes back on March 25th. The book just came out. We got a lot to talk about. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. You're in town in New York doing the press tour, a little busy, first time experiencing snow.
I think this is first time a snowflake has touched my hair.
How old are you?
I'm 30.
Jesus Christ.
Because in Hong Kong, there's no snow.
Yeah, but you've never been to another part of the world or in America?
We're trying to not go there in the winter, I guess.
Well, you don't have to get defensive about it. I'm just asking if you've been to
Guys,
snow.
I have lived. Okay.
Don't try to make me into being a nasty white guy who's attacking an Asian guy for not experiencing snow.
Dropping snowflakes on my head.
You know what you could do is you could get ice cubes that are in your refrigerator and scrape off the frost over your head. That's pretty much snow.
That's snow? Oh, cool.
If you cared
I might
to do
have
any.
Done that before.
You should have done due diligence on snow, man. I don't know what you're You were born in Hong Kong, mm-hmm. and you are an Asian version of my family. I'm Italian, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of stuff in your life, and you talk about in this book about your family and how they relate to what you chose to do. And but you said in an article, my parents, they want stability for us. It's not that they don't want us to do certain things. They just want us to do jobs that are steady. They mm-hmm. want us to play it safe. And that's exactly, I came middle-class background, high school educated parents. And a lot of this resonates with me because
that's,
I think
that's
it's
great.
Yeah.
That's so great to hear. Cause I don't want to make this book just for immigrants or just for Asian people. I hope it's relatable to everybody.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, you know, and some of the things you talk about in the book about like, and you're just really funny about your parents. On like page 4, you say, I always have to brace myself when I visit my parents. My mom often greets me with a slew of non-constructive criticisms.
That's true. Old Asian ladies will tell you exactly what is wrong with your face.
Right? Like you got pimples or what?
Jimmy, your face is so fat. What? Your hair looks homeless. Why? And after like 30 years of this, I've low self-esteem now.
Is that where the... Well, you know, I know it's a memoir, but in reading it, I was sort of like... I can't tell if this is like a written bit or if it's real, but it feels all real to me. Like,
it's all real. I mean, even most of my stand-up bits, they're all real stuff. Yeah. I think that's why it's funny, right? You want the audience sitting there. It's like, oh my God, I got an aunt like that. Or it's so funny because it's true.
Yeah. Well, you know? I get like, when are you going to have your own TV show? That's what I get when I go home sometimes.
Like, why don't you try getting on Letterman?
You know, yeah. Like, well, you know, and then when you've done that, so now the last thing for me is have my own show. So they'll go like, when are you going to get your own TV show? And I go, you know, I had like 4 things to do today. I had to pick up some dry cleaning and 3 was call CBS for my TV show. I'll probably put that up at number one and do that. Why didn't I think of that?
I haven't returned CBS's voicemail, so I'll get on that, Ma.
This woman, Les Moonves, keeps calling me. I think it's a woman. I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very relatable. And obviously you talk about it in your act, but sort of to take it to a book is a whole other level. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to write a book and get a book deal on that. So, but was it sort of this goal to kind of get this out there from a perspective of an Asian family that maybe people don't understand or haven't, been familiar with at all?
I think it's good to have more of this material out there, like fresh off the boat. Eddie Huang's book that eventually turned into a show and this kind of stuff, to have Asian material out there, but also a relatable immigrant story that you might not need to be from an immigrant background, but if you're interested in knowing it, because I think everything now is so, either this way or that way, conservative or liberal, and then they have an argument about everything. But this book is just a very true story that without picking sides, that hopefully people can learn a thing or two or kind of see firsthand from my POV of how an immigrant was when I first came to this country when I was 13 years old to now.
Yeah.
And develop their own opinions.
You know, there was something interesting about growing up in Hong Kong and was it the mainland China people sort of looked down their nose at you and you felt, I was very fascinated by that.
It's
you
the
felt,
other way.
I'm sorry, the other way. And you felt sort of isolated because of that, right? In some way?
So my family are from Shanghai, which is mainland China, and they speak Shanghainese and Mandarin. And I was born in Hong Kong, so I was born, one of my first languages was Cantonese. But so that's what I would speak in school, but I would speak Shanghainese to my parents back home. And all the kids will make fun of my parents calling my dad like the Shanghai dude or something like that because he'll speak Cantonese with a Shanghainese accent. So it's like a weird internal racism thing.
Yeah. So how did that affect you when you were a kid? Did you feel excluded from one group or another? Or
it was, I guess, some early training on assimilation, you know, not
within your own country or between Hong Kong and mainland China.
Like I felt a little different, but it was never like extremely bad in Hong Kong. And it wasn't anything like that. It's just, I know it was a bit different. I wasn't these Cantonese dudes,
right?
You know, even though I was speaking Cantonese.
And what is, define what a Cantonese dude is vis-a-vis someone who's not, for people that
so
won't
Cantonese
know.
Is from the province of Canton, basically, Guangdong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Hong Kong, which was a British colony, and it has its own government. It's a very different state in itself, and the surrounding area of mainland China, like Shenzhen and stuff like that.
No, but I don't mean geographically. Oh. I mean in terms of the type of person you're talking about, like what the distinctions between someone you know, with that sort of Cantonese background versus, you know, Shanghai.
So it's, Hong Kong's the big city. So is Shanghai. But Shanghai's the mainland city. And Hong Kong always have a superiority complex thinking they're better because they were under British rule. They had a more westernized, not communist government. So they always turn their nose up to everybody else that comes in, right? If people don't speak Cantonese properly, they make fun of them. If I brought Shanghainese food to school instead of, you know, say a more traditional Hong Kong thing, they will make fun of that.
But they have a complex. Like, I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, and Lisa's from Boston. And Boston and people from Providence, Rhode Island, have we're stuck between New York and Boston. So we have a complex when it comes to those two bigger cities. And you know, so there's this like, well, the North End food in Providence, which is Italian, is better than the North End food in Boston. It's like, it's like an hour away. Really.
You always have to find an enemy.
Right.
A rival. It's like a sports team. I guess that's what makes life exciting.
Yeah.
And when you're within China, you hate on each other.
Right.
You know, America or even East Coast, West Coast beef. Yeah. You got to find somebody.
Right.
To kind of turn your nose up against.
And, at 13, you came here. You didn't really speak English, I would imagine.
I had learned English on paper, like how kids here would learn Spanish.
Oh, really?
But that's not, I can't have a conversation.
Right.
Like if you just send your kid, that's 13-year-old, to Mexico, he's not going he's not going to do very well.
Yeah, he's not going to start negotiating treaties or anything.
Yeah.
When you came here, how difficult was it? Because I just had a conversation with somebody who came here when they were six from South Korea. And he was really, he was the only Korean, Asian kid in his school, in his neighborhood. And I was waiting for the next thing to be like, you know, he was like, you know, treated poorly or whatever. And he said, everybody really embraced him and really thought he was, you know, try to sort of help him along. Did you find that when you came here?
It's a little bit of both. 13 is an interesting age. It's an awkward age, I think, for anyone.
Yeah.
And I was going into eighth grade. Like six, I think you'll be going to first grade. So that's a little different. So 13, people are, you know, hitting puberty. They have their own clique already. Yeah. So it's a bit hard to penetrate those cliques. And some of my first friends were like Mexican-Americans or immigrants. And I had a Nigerian friend.
This is in California.
In California when I went to school in L.A.
Right.
But it was just weird. Like a lot of things I've never seen. Like I thought I was a good basketball player back home.
And well, you have a lot of height. It's clear.
Right.
You're
obviously
probably a center, right?
Yeah, I'm practically Yao Ming. But when I came here, like I literally the first day I stepped on like the playing field, like the court. That's how good I am in basketball. I just said playing field. Well, the first day I stepped on the court.
Well, you shouldn't say swimming pool.
That's true. Yeah. First day I stepped on the court, this dude Marquise was like 6'2" and like 200 pounds. He's like, he looked like LeBron James when he was 13 and he just dunked. He just dunked. A 13-year-old just dunked. And it just completely shattered everything I believed in, and also different things like cultural things like Pledge of Allegiance, which kids here have been doing since, I don't know, when was Pledge of Allegiance started? Like first grade or something?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm Russian, so I don't try not to pay attention to any of that. I mean, since certainly when I was born, I mean, forever, yeah.
So when I was dropped in the first period homeroom, I saw all the kids standing up, putting their hand on their chest, doing the Pledge of Allegiance. I had no idea what it was. I thought it was some like
group heart attack.
Like a chant or like a cult that I just joined. I didn't know what the words meant, Pledge of Allegiance to the what. And
there was a big vat of Kool-Aid off to the left. You're like, what's going on here?
Yeah, I never learned allegiance in my vocabulary.
Right.
You know? So I just followed. And I did everything by following it.
Mm.
And that's how you try to fit in at first. I just didn't try to stick out like a sore thumb.
Yeah,
and then when the teacher read my name, when she called roll, it's like, okay, Marquise Daniel here, Manxing Oh, I'm like, I'm here. Just call me Jimmy, please.
Did you just come up with Jimmy, or how did that come about?
So,
because it's John. Tell people the
character name is Jing Yang on HBO.
Right, but I mean, how did you come up with Jimmy?
Jimmy was a given name by my parents because everybody in Hong Kong, because since Hong Kong was a British state, you were born with a Chinese name on your regular, passport and stuff.
Right.
But you have an English nickname for school purposes and whatever. People just have English nicknames.
Yeah.
And like, for example, my dad is named Richard. Because he told me he wanted to be rich. It's very simple, right?
A lot of thought went into it.
My brother was named Roger because he was named after Roger Moore. One of my my parents' favorite James
really?
Bond. Wow. Yeah, but then he hated that name. He eventually changed it to Roy because he
the hamburger chain?
Roy the hamburger chain?
What's Roy? What's the one that would sell hamburgers? Why am I forgetting? Anyway, go ahead. I'll come back to it. There's a hamburger chain with Roy something in it. But anyway, go ahead.
Now it's familiar. Because he thought Roger was like an old white guy name, so he changed it to Roy, which is ironic because that's an old black guy name.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and I was just named Jimmy. I asked my parents why. They're like, no, it just sounded good.
That's it? That's how they picked it?
That was it.
And
I mean, half of all Chinese people are named Jimmy.
I had no idea.
Yeah, there's a lot of Jimmys out there.
And I had no idea that there was this thing in the culture that you had to have a nickname.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess is the idea that America is the large country that you're going to deal with, so sort of relate to them? Is that why they wanted it to be an American sort of...
Well, it's when Hong Kong was a British colony when I was born in 87.
Right.
You know, it got turned back to China in 1997, but it still prides itself into being a very international city.
Right.
So Jimmy was never on my passport until I became American citizen and I put Jimmy as my middle name. Because my real Chinese name, my given name, was Man Xing, which in Chinese
is way better than Jimmy. No, it is. It's way cooler.
It's cool. But when you're...
You can get laid with that name.
I don't know. When you were in middle school, wasn't that cool?
I don't know.
You were weird. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, no, I know.
You want to be normal when you were a kid. You didn't want to get made fun of, you know? And Man Xing means 10,000 success in Chinese, which is a name that is sure to set me up for failure.
Did you, I was kind of little and scrawny and there was some, like a few guys that would like to beat people up. So I think I used comedy as a way to kind of avoid
same.
Did you do the same thing?
I think that was my first.
And to kind of ingratiate yourself into this new group, maybe?
Yeah, that was my first defense mechanism and my first, I guess, set, really, right?
Right,
it was
right.
From the bullies or when people were making fun of you, just trying to make funny and try to ingratiate yourself. One time, though, I did, for some reason, I just had enough of these two kids that was like really bothering me in PE class. And out of instinct, I turned around. Mind you, I've never taken a martial arts class in my life.
Mm.
But I turned around, roundhouse kicked him in the stomach. He folded over and I jumped up and I karate chopped him in the back of the neck. And then his friend just like pulled him away and be like, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. Okay, don't fuck with him. That's Bruce Lee.
So you had two moves and you used them
both?
That's
it. It was just out of instinct from whatever kung fu flick I've seen when I was in Hong Kong. And nobody really bothered me after
that's
that
almost
day.
Like a form of racism, like, but you fed into it.
I stereotyped myself.
You created, you stereotyped yourself.
Yeah, but I used it to my benefit because now they thought I knew some kung fu secret.
See, like I'm Italian, so like if I had like a sport coat on and in that situation, I just like slowly reached into the inside of my sport coat, people would have thought... This guy's got a gun and he's Italian with like...
You'd use people's racism against them.
I'm going to start doing that.
Yeah.
I should have done that years ago. So you said, you talk about how to pursue your dreams with Asian parents on page 10. You say, in America, people always tell me money can't buy happiness. Do you want love? Do what you love. In my Chinese family, my dad always tells me pursuing your dreams is for losers. Do what you love is how you become... homeless.
This is true.
And this is true?
The synonym for artist in my household is homeless.
Your dad did what? What was his...
He was a businessman in China, and then when he came here, he became a financial advisor.
Okay.
So steady jobs, real jobs, according to him, right? And what you're saying about your parents, I think the older generation, they didn't have that many options, especially my dad growing up in the Chinese Revolution.
Right.
He needed to find a safe job. He wished he could have went to a real university and got a real job with a degree.
Yeah.
But that wasn't a choice
for him. My mom was the same way. She couldn't go. They can only send, she had four, her parents were born in Italy, my grandparents, and they had four kids. And it was like a Sophie's Choice moment. And they had four kids and they only can afford to send one to college.
So they
picked my Uncle John, who was clearly the brilliant, like they put their money on him. Like he's got the most hope. So they put it on him.
And so much pressure.
Yeah, and he went out to Georgetown Dentistry School. He was brilliant. He was also really racist. But and my mom ended up starting her own furniture business because she wanted that. Have something of her own, but she always wanted to go to college. You know, that was a big thing for her, you know?
Yeah, I think I get it. Like, I get why, you know, our parents want that for us because they never had the opportunity themselves.
Yeah, and it does make life easier, in theory, yeah. Anyway, yeah. Right. I mean, you went to UC San Diego, right? Mm-hmm. And you were like an economics, finance and a degree in economics. So you were kind of on that path. But then you studied, you were like abroad in Florence and then you came, you were kind of bopping around in Europe and stuff. And then you came back and kind of were... kind of, you know,
I was just trying to figure out what I wanted to do because I know I didn't want to do finance or economics.
Why? It just didn't.
I mean, who does?
Yeah, right? What?
I mean, there's nobody that loves.
Jews. There, I said it. Okay.
Look, okay. There's nobody that loves.
My show, I can be
finance.
As racist as I want. Go ahead.
Nobody that loves economy. You can love money. And that's fine. But nobody loves finance.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't want to handle other people's mutual funds.
Yeah.
What's in that for me? Yeah. Like, I don't get it. So I was just kind of bumbling around. You know, I took out some student loans and I went to Florence for 4 months. And that was a great time.
That's a great place to
be. It gave me like really good perspective on certain things.
And what were you doing there? Were you working or were you just sort of hanging out?
I was taking classes, but useless classes. Like architecture, wine tasting, food critique. There's a class called History of the Mafia.
Oh.
And they really just showed us Godfather 2.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was great. And none of those credits transfer back to UCSD.
What's your thesis in that? Do you have to go out and whack somebody? At least sell stuff out of the trunk of your car.
I think the teacher was like an ex-mafioso or something like that. I don't know. Or he worked in a crime unit.
That's a class you pay attention to and you don't want to get your teacher mad. That's cool, though.
None of those credits transfer and I have to go to UCSD for a fifth year. But it was cool. And then ending up, my commencement speaker turned out to be Mike Judge.
At UC San Diego.
He's like the only cool person that's ever went to UC San Diego. And he talked about how he was a physics major and he didn't want to do that. He was working in Silicon Valley in the 80s and he didn't like that culture.
Yeah.
So eventually he found his passion in animation and comedy.
Yeah.
And that really spoke to me.
Yeah, well, I was a lawyer and investment banker on Wall Street and I quit to be a comedian. No joke. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, well, it was a hard transition because I was like, am I going to do
this? And you
were
making a ton of money, I bet.
Yeah, I was doing M&A deals and then I was like, oh, I think I'm just going to chuck this and start all over again. I sold my apartment. I sold everything.
Wow.
Because when you start out doing stand-up,
you got nothing.
You got to build it from the ground up and go do hell gigs and
absolutely
dive bars and all that stuff. And then kind of, you know, so I totally get it, you know. I mean, I was pretty far into that life, so I thought I had everything figured out. And then I'm like, well, no, geez, I kind of really like creating my own stuff and people, you know, responding to it, you know, which you can relate to, obviously. And it's like, so I get it. Like, it's good that you figured that out then at 2021 and you didn't spend 10-15 years, you know?
I mean, especially after studying abroad, after listening to Mike's commencement speech, I didn't figure out I needed to do stand-up. I had no idea I would do stand-up, eventually go into acting, eventually work for Mike.
Yeah.
No idea.
Well, I was going to say, was there some connection that led to
not
the,
at all.
Did you just
went to an audition, and then Mike had no idea. I was sitting in the audience.
Right.
But then he just hired me, and then the first day at table read, I was like, hey, man, you were my commencement speaker. And, you know, Mike's like a very quiet but super cool genius guy. Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, that's cool.
Right. That's about as much you're going to get. Yeah. Did you have to go through multiple rounds of audition?
Because it was such a small part.
Yeah.
It was literally, it started off as a 2-line part.
Yeah.
So I got it in one audition on tape. It wasn't even in front of Mike or whatever.
Usually
I just got the part,
and
right?
How did it build to be more? Was that through you just sort of suggesting other things to them or?
I think they started seeing, like, as I had 2-line parts, maybe in 3 episodes in the first season, and they started seeing maybe they can use me, especially with TJ. Like, we just kind of hit it off.
Yeah.
And then it just got more and more, and he started developing more of a 3-dimensional character and becoming more and more of an asshole. Because I think they see that, you know, he was getting bullied a little bit in the beginning.
Yeah.
So it's great now to have a revenge story. He can be as mean as he wants to TJ.
Right.
And people love it.
Yeah.
You know?
Had you had much acting training leading into that?
Yeah, I had. One of my favorite parts of the book was the 101 auditions that led to the 102nd audition, which is Silicon Valley.
Yeah, that's a great, talk about that a little bit.
And I auditioned for everything from, you know, Dog with a Blog, a Disney show where you talk to a blog, to like the dude eating buffalo wings at Chili's, you know? And I took a ton of acting classes and the audition process is hard.
Yeah, it is.
That's in itself a sport, right? So I was spending $300 in rent money renting a living room on Craigslist, but I was spending $600 on acting classes every month.
Yeah,
so
or workshops with casting directors that you do to get in front of
casting
directors.
That's a big thing now.
Yeah, and then the thing is, if you're a stand-up, some people fall into the trap. You think, well, I'm a stand-up, so I can act because I'm a performer. And it's a completely different discipline, because if you're doing stand-up, right, you're actually bifurcating your mind and you're focused on what's going on, listening to the audience, and sort of also doing your act at the same time and seeing what's working and what's not. And if you're in acting, you can't be out of yourself looking and assessing what you're doing. You got to be in the scene, in the moment, nothing else.
Exactly.
So it's a different set of muscles that you really have to like develop and stay, you know, like sharp with. So the auditioning is a way to stay sharp and taking these classes and stuff.
Yeah, that was huge. Taking the acting classes. Like, you know, I had a few breakthroughs that really, you know, led me to be more truthful in my acting, and that really helped. And also learning to listen to your acting partner. Because stand-ups, I think we run into the trap of, we keep thinking, what are we going to say next? What I can do next?
Because it is about you up there, really. I mean, it's like moving it along.
It's a one-man sport, stand-up. And acting, it's a team sport. You got to pass the ball. You got to be able to catch the ball and pass it.
Right. I wanted to mention, there's something else that you talked about in the book. You said, it's on page 12, you say, so instead of forcing my parents to accept the American mindset, I quietly rebelled, got a degree in finance, but didn't work, and eventually pursued comedy when I was 21, had to disappoint them in order to pursue my dream. Stand-up isn't a thing in China. Bankers, doctors, scientists are what make Asians proud. How hard was that, though, to kind of push back against that? Because when I did it, I was beyond the point where my parents... opinion mattered. You know, I was out of the house now, and I had my own full-fledged career, and I was about to be married and everything. How hard was that at a young age to like rebel against really dominant parents like that?
Yeah, it's tough, because my dad was the one that hooked me up with the internship in finance.
Yeah.
And I came home one day, I never seen my dad so happy. He's like, after my friend just called me, after you're done with the internship, they're going to offer you a job here at Smith Barney.
Mm.
And I'm like, and I have never been so shook. Mm. I was like, I don't want to do this. I just saw my life flash in front of me behind a desk.
Yeah.
And I had to tell him, like, that's not what I want to do. Mm. I want to go do something else. He's like, do you have another job lined up? I'm like, no, I'm just going to do stand up and figure it out. So I think it's really hard on him.
Yeah.
But he would always send me careerbuilder.com emails. Like every other day, he's like, Jimmy, real people is hiring out there. You know, your talk shows might not be working out. He doesn't know what stand-up is. He just calls it a talk show.
Shows.
Yeah. All he knows is like Jay Leno back in the day. He's like, you going to like Gene Leno? My talk show in the Laugh Factory?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, no.
But
okay,
did
whatever.
He do what my parents did, which was once they start to see you have some success, they get their head around it a little bit better?
I think what they worried about the most was my stability.
Yeah.
And I don't go homeless.
Yeah.
So they still might not understand the art of it, but they understand that I'm on TV show now. I'm doing fine financially and I'm not going to be starving. So that eased their mind. But I think deep down, my dad still wished I was a scientist.
Yeah. And what was it about stand-up? I mean, I know from reading up on this about you, but tell the folks, like, what drew you to that? Because you were, it seemed like being in Florence, you were kind of, you know, a little bit finding yourself, whatever you want to call it. Like, so what was it about that clicked for you?
Like I said, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just know I didn't want to do that finance crap.
Right.
So I tried different things. I tried jujitsu classes, boxing classes. I was just trying to find a new community. I wasn't like necessarily trying to be an MMA fighter or anything.
This is in LA.
Yeah. In San Diego and LA.
Mm-hmm.
And then the summer, I came back to LA and I searched for local open mics, because I always thought I was funny because from all this training, from defending myself with the bullies and stuff
and
like that.
And were you into comedy? Like when I was a kid, I'd love to watch the stand-ups on the late shows. Mm-hmm. Were you into that at all?
I wasn't when I was a kid because there wasn't comedy.
But wait, when you moved
Hong
here
Kong.
At 13.
When I moved here, I discovered stand-up from BET, from Comic View. And I thought it was so interesting. Because it wasn't just teaching me about the language. It was teaching me about the culture.
Oh, because they were talking about, gotcha.
Like, white people do this, black people do that. I didn't know that. Like, in China, it's just Chinese people, you know? So that was so interesting to me. And, you know, definitely I took after that. And I think I said this in the book. Googling local open mics is one step right before you Google what's the best way to kill yourself. And I did that because I was desperate.
Yeah.
And then when I got on that stage, I wasn't very funny. Nobody's very funny.
No.
When they first start, but I found that community. It was a community of misfits, of outsiders, just like me.
Yeah.
And it felt like the more outside you are, the more you fit in stand-up. Mm. And I absolutely loved that. And even I was talking about like really hacky masturbation jokes or whatever.
Well, but everybody does in the beginning because you're not sure who you are yet. You're not comfortable enough revealing that on stage. It's a very, very sort of unnatural place to be.
It is. You're just trying to get a couple of chuckles.
Yeah, you're holding on for dear life, and you're just, you know, so if you charted like the quality of the jokes of people that start doing stand-up when they first start out, you're going to see a ton of masturbation jokes, dick jokes, blowjob jokes, McDonald's jokes, stuff that, because I think on some level you want to please, and you please by relating to people, and you relate to them by talking about common things.
Right. Because that's what makes your buddy laugh when you're talking about jerking off.
Exactly. Yeah. But then if you go beyond that, hopefully if you're doing it right, you get beyond that and then you go to, I want to really talk about like what makes me stay up at night and what I worry about.
What do you want to talk about? Your truth.
Who you are, because then that defines who you are and that makes you distinctive. And then that also sort of, there's nobody else like you. There's nobody else like me. It's our job as writers, I think, to tap into who we are and then get that out there. But that's impossible to do when you first start.
You just try to survive.
It's like, you know, 16 sets of eyes looking at you going, what the, whoa, okay, I got to do this now.
Yeah. And what's great about that, I really felt like I found a community because whatever ridiculous crap I was just saying on stage, other comedians came up to me. He's like, yo, maybe you tag along with this. Yeah. I'm like, yo, I was just talking about jerking off, but they took it seriously, like as if it was an art form. And that was so interesting. And there was no barrier of entry. It's all about just grinding it out.
And
so
culturally,
I really respected that.
And were you one of the few or many Asians in that community? Like, were
few.
You,
yeah. I mean, even now there's not a lot of
And
Asian
they were,
comedians.
You were okay. And the people treated you all right with that? Like they weren't,
yeah.
there was no.
Because like, it was LA. You know, I've done other gigs where people looked at me funny and I have to address that, you know, In the beginning, like, hey, yeah, look, I'm an Asian guy.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, when I was watching some stand-up when I came to America, I saw Bobby Lee doing great on Matt TV. Mm. I saw Ken Jeong, from Showtime to Apollo to The Hangover. And then that fan won Last Comic Standing.
Right.
And like just seeing Asian faces doing these things make it feel like it's possible. And I hope that, you know, for me, I do the same thing with the younger, maybe generation, right? With writing, with acting and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, the book is great and because it's funny, but it's also poignant in places. And it's also, it shows you got balls because you're going up against your parents and that's not easy. I'm not trying to paint your parents as being.
Oh, no.
I get it. You know what I mean? Like you say another thing in the book, you say, the most important values in America or culture are independence and freedom. The most important values in Chinese culture are family and obedience. Mm-hmm. And by no choice of my own, I am caught in between the two worlds. That's a tough place to be when you're 19, 20, 21, you know, and trying to figure it out.
Because you want to be cool in school. You want to be normal.
Yeah.
That's all you wanted to be when you're a teenager.
Yeah.
But you don't want to disrespect your parents.
Yeah.
I jokingly say sometimes, I'm like, I wish my dad would have just beat me or be horrible to me so I can just say fuck you and then just go with American culture.
Right.
But I can't. He's a wonderful man.
Yeah.
My mom was awesome. So like, you know, it's hard to kind of balance the two.
Yeah, you want to please people, especially your parents if they're good parents. Have they come to see you do stand up and what that's
oh,
like?
Oh boy. Yeah, I was doing a week at the MGM at Brad Garrett's Club.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most beautiful clubs, and it's at the MGM, so even my parents know that's a good place.
Mm.
So I invited them, flew them out, you know, set them in the best seats, took care of everything, and I had a pretty good set that night, right? And then as I was, as everybody was filtering out, everybody would like shake my hands and stuff like that. I'm like, okay, let my parents see this real quick.
Yeah.
And then my buddy, who was the feature that night, he went up to my dad. He was like, hey, so aren't you just proud of Jimmy? He was so funny, right? And then my dad's like, no, I don't think he's funny. He seriously didn't understand stand-up because it's so cultural.
Yeah. I had my mother come and she wanted to sit like near the stage. I'm like, no, don't sit near the stage because it's too, she's my kryptonite because it's your mother and you know, whatever.
Yeah.
She can't hear for shit. She was born deaf in one ear, half no hearing in the other. She's 90 now.
Oh my.
So she insists on coming. So we put her at a table with my sister and a couple of people. So they take care of her. And she's like, so I'm headlining, right? So I'm doing my thing and it's sold out and whatever. And I'm doing great. And then, and I'm not looking in that area. And I can perform in front of I don't want to sign whatever. Like, I'm at the point I can perform in front of anybody and do anything. But that's just a little. Because another time she came to see me and she had her hand in her chin the whole time and she was staring at me like she was looking at a CAT scan. Like, it was like, right? So anyway, I turn back and all of a sudden I see, my mother's like about 4'9" now, and I see this little shadow of a person like hovering, moving from left to right in the back of the room.
Uh-oh.
And it was my mother trying to get near one of the speakers so she could hear me better.
Oh, but that's nice.
Shut up. And you try being up there. And this thing, now it's like the biggest distraction on the face of the planet. Now, I'm doing my act because we can do our act and like, right? You can like almost balance your checkbook in your head at the same time. And it's not stopping. And in the middle of the set, I go, Ma, sit down. And everybody looks at me like, what?
That's hilarious.
And she looks down. I go, sit down. And I look at my sister Karen and I go, Karen. And I motion like, what the fuck? What? And I'm like, motion, get her back to the table. And they got her back to the table. And people were leaving and people were taking pictures with me and I was signing autographs. And she would go to people, you think my son's funny? I don't think he's that funny. He was never funny as a kid. I'm like, you're the worst publicist on the face of the
earth. God, why do they do that?
Because I honestly think a little bit of it is a power thing. Like,
right, to have it over you.
And my mother's also a real, like, she needs to be the center of attention. Mm. I mean, she's not getting it.
My dad, he was always the funny one, the family.
Yeah, my father would lay back. My mother would be the one that had to kind of whatever. And so if she's not getting it, she finds other ways to take it away from you. But you know, she's your mother. Like, what are you gonna do? But
I totally relate.
We have very similar parents, probably, you know, different ages.
They should hang out.
We should definitely, and we should let them hang out and kill
that
each other.
That would
with
be
their,
great. And videotape exactly. them in secret. That's a good reality show.
Before you go, any like you talked about the 101 auditions, mm-hmm. any crazy shit happened in some hell gigs when you first started or recently or dive bars?
I talked about like one of the worst gigs ever. Was in the south side of San Diego. And San Diego, certain parts of it is very conservative and possibly racist.
Mm.
I did this dive bar show. Because, you know, when you first start, you do everything. You're just happy to get some stage time that's not an open mic. So I went to this dive bar. And there was an audience member literally screamed out the N-word to the comedian on stage. And the comedian was white. And the worst part was everybody around the dude started laughing like that was cool and funny. So I'm like, oh, shit, I'm going to die tonight.
So dumb racism.
Yeah. So, I mean, and they drunk, the ignorance. So I went up to the DJ, which was just a dude holding an iPod, really. And I was like, play this song when I get up there. And I got up there. I feel like this is like a situation I got to address, right? So I got up there. The dude played a song. And then it was like, everybody was kung fu fighting. I was using the racism against them.
Yeah.
And then I said, cut the music. And I'm like, what's up, you racist motherfuckers? And that got the attention. I was nervous for a second. There was a moment of silence, but then that got them.
Yeah.
You know, they got respect for that because I was calling them out on their bullshit.
And that guy that yelled out the N-word, he didn't give any shit?
I think he might have bought me a six-pack after. I'm not sure. But, you know, I got them after that. And I was able to even do my Asian material.
Hey,
some of
Jimmy, you must be good at math, too. Like, you probably came over and put your arm around me. By the way, the Korean kid that came over here when he was 7, they start math a lot earlier in Korea anyway. Oh, yeah. So he was 2-3 years ahead.
Same.
So he said all the kids really wanted to cheat off him and stuff because he was so good at math and so ahead of everybody in his class. He was 2-3 grades ahead.
Exactly.
In math, at least.
Same for me. When I came here, I already learned algebra, but they put me in like basic math and everything.
Yeah.
And then when they finally did put me in algebra class, which was the highest class in 8th grade, my dad asked me, he was like, so have you taken algebra before? I was like, no. Never taken algebra, first time. And then, of course, you know, I became like an easy A. It was awesome.
And your dad was so proud.
Oh, he was rocking a Student of the Month sticker on the back of his Chrysler Sebring convertible.
That's awesome. Sebring, that's a nice car.
Yeah, that was his midlife crisis car, I
think.
There
you go. So you're on tour. Where can people see you on tour? You're going out in April, I think you said?
Yeah, so first stop, San Jose Improv on the 28th of March. And then Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Sacramento, San Francisco, a lot of stuff coming up. You can go on jimmycomedy.com. That's my website. It has everything.
Got it. Okay. Where are you in New York?
The Bell House in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, that'll be fun. Maybe I'll come out and hang and see you.
That'll be awesome.
I'll yell racist stuff to you.
Do it. Do it. Yell the N-word when I'm on stage. See what happens.
And where can they...
actually, don't do
social
it.
Media and stuff? Where they going to do...
You can find me at Funny Asian Dude on Twitter, Instagram, and all that good stuff.
Dude, you're so racist of yourself. The book, the book is How to American, which I love. It says not for sale, but I'm selling it.
Well, you have the early reader copy. The real copy just came out a couple days ago, so...
I'm selling this.
You can buy it. Yeah. Oh, this is worth some money. There's only maybe, what, like 20 advanced reader copies.
I'm selling it. An Immigrant's Guide to Disappointing Your Parents. And March 25th is Silicon Valley. Good luck, man. It's really great having you on, and we'll do this again, and maybe
come
to LA or whatever. Yeah.
Yes, I would love to, yeah.
Keep being Asian, man. You're awesome.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Jimmy O. Wang. Nice guy. He's funny. Parents are, well, you heard it. But he's turned it into gold, man. He's doing great. All right. March 23rd and 24th, Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey. Bananas Comedy Club. Come see me. Or March 28th to the 31st at Rick Bronson's House of Comedy in Bloomington, Minnesota. And please continue, if you haven't done so, I should say, leave some nice comments on iTunes about the show. Always helps. All right, folks, thanks as always for checking out the show, and check you out next week.